You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Don, do I get to say that forever now?
No, we have a major change in the weather coming up, actually.
Oh, no.
Or the rather significant part of the conversation. We'll get to that in just a moment. But this show is broadcasting on April 24th, 2025. High today, as we're recording the show, is going to be 72. High the day of the broadcast, get this, folks, 68. Night temperature 48, Thursday night temperature 47, mostly cloudy. Friday, a high on Friday of 66 degrees. Mostly sunny, but there's a storm coming in. Not much of a storm. I call this fungus weather, as longtime listeners know. Friday night, 44 degrees with a 30% chance of showers. Saturday, the high Saturday is going to be 65 degrees.
What?
Yes, with a slight chance of showers on Saturday. Clearing out mostly, but still partly cloudy Saturday night with a low of 45 degrees.
So is it time to plant tomatoes?
This is getting quite silly because it's that, you know, Monday, Tuesday of this week, 80 degrees. And we're looking ahead. We're looking at some pretty high temperatures, but these night temperatures are low. Many people, of course, have already put their summer vegetables in the ground. So really the question is, what's going to happen to them? Well, they'll sit there. The tomatoes will turn kind of purplish. Tomatoes planted now going into warmer weather will recover, but if you haven't planted them yet, don't rush. If you haven't planted your peppers and eggplant, don't. Hold them in a nice warm place near your house while we get through these few days of colder nights, because here's what the long-range forecast is looking like. So Monday, let's see, did I say Sunday? Sunday is going to be 70 with a night temperature of 46. Monday, sunny with a high near 78. Ooh, that's seeming more seasonably appropriate. Monday night, 49 degrees and clear. Tuesday is going to be 80 degrees. And here we go into next week. Wednesday, 86 with a low of 53.
Oh, wow.
Thursday, 88 with a low of 53. So May 1st, May Day will be, according to Weather Underground at least, 88 degrees. And this Friday is going to be 69 degrees. 20 degree temperature swing in 1 week may confuse us, will certainly confuse some of your vegetables. But the good news is that we're going into a warmer trend. Soil is warming up. We're getting there. Funny conversations with people every day at my garden center, like, should I plant? Shouldn't I plant? This is a case where your raised planter beds can make a pretty big difference because they can warm the soil up. So if they're in there, this is the other question. What do? I already put them in. Well, you don't do anything. You just wait. What I do predict from this is folks who got theirs in early and are looking at them and seeing the flowers on there and going, oh, goody, I'm going to get some early fruit. I'm going to go ahead and mark my calendar this year, just as I did last year and the year before, because we had almost exactly the same weather phenomenon last year. And I'm going to mark it 6 to 7 weeks out, and I'm just going to write blossom end rot ? Because we know the cold temperatures and wet soil are correlated with blossom end rot. So that's the only real risk. And here's the thing about that. You can see the fruit developing on your early ones, Roma, early girl, whatever you've got, a couple weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. Look on the bottom of the fruit. Before you get the gushy, rotten part, it already is typically discoloring and looking a little mottled. So if that happens, pick that fruit off, fling it away. The next fruit will probably come on fine. So warming trend, but a brief cold, strange spell, and definitely fungus weather.
If you have small tomatoes and they would fit underneath a milk carton, some people put out milk cartons at night when it's going to be below 50. Is that a smart thing to do?
Yeah, we were just talking about this with someone who was looking at the weather. They'd already got them in the ground. They're concerned about this. And so I suggest, yeah, just take a large milk, you know, not carton, not waxed type, but we're talking plastic jug type thing. Cut the bottom off, slip it right over the plant. Try to do it in the late afternoon when there's still a chance for some sunlight to go on there. Create this little tiny greenhouse. And that will warm things up and the plant will definitely be happier about that. If you can do that, 2 liter soda bottle will do the same thing. Most important thing, Don't forget to leave that on there. It's going to be 88 degrees in 6 days. So that would definitely cook them, but it would help. Frost blanket is another option, not because we're expecting a frost by any stretch, just to warm it up, just to get the plants through this weird cool spell. We have these here. There's a reason we say at our garden center, for best results, we plant tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May, because peppers and eggplant are particularly affected by these colder temperatures. Enough about that. We've got a couple important announcements.
Well, coming up on May 1st, there is a very important day for most of the nonprofits in our area. This is called the Big Day of Giving, and it's one day where they all try and get you to go and make a donation to them. And we participate in that. So we'll tell you more about it. It's May 1st, and hopefully you'll give some money to somebody. You could do it to Davis Media Access or to KDRT.
Davis Media Access? What's that?
Well, that's our parent ship, yeah. Our mothership.
Our mothership. So if you go to Big Day of Giving website and you're looking around for all these cool local nonprofits, the one to look for is Davis Media Access. Oh, I'll throw in Tree Davis, and there's probably five others I could throw in there as well that are very worthwhile. But for this purpose, for the Garden Show and Jazz After Dark and That's Life and the other 29 or 30 great programs that you love so much here at KDRT, Big Day of Giving, what day was that?
May 1st.
Mayday.
And the URL is davismediaaccess/bigdog.
Davismediaaccess.org?
Well, yeah. Davismediaaccess.org/bigdog.
Big Dog. Big Day of Giving. There you go.
Yeah.
We appreciate your support in years past. We love the fact that there's listeners all over the world. You are the folks that keep this show on the air. So thank you very much for your past contributions. And if you're just walking around May 1 trying to think of something good to do, Big Day of Giving, Davis Media Access, KDRT. Thank you very much. Well, it is spring. All kinds of questions are coming in. I'm in the retail nursery business. I'm answering questions all day long about an amazing array of things. And we get list questions from you folks out there. Lois, is there anything in the mailbag?
Okay, I have a letter here from Jenny. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. But she starts out with, I emailed a couple weeks ago and mentioned not being able to find episodes dating back further than a couple of years. Since then, I found the archives on kdrt.org, and I am thrilled. Like many, you've been keeping me company as I work in the garden for hours upon hours. Thank you.
Yep, they are. Kdrt.org, you go to the Davis Garden Show page, and I think every show is there all the way back to 2005. Happy 20th anniversary, Lois.
We missed two that didn't get recorded early on. That's it. All right. But here's her question. Jenny asks, please see the photos attached. Mm-hmm. In the front yard, there is a rose garden that's been here since 1960, and we plan to keep it. Bordering that and our neighbor's front yard used to be a juniper-esque hedge that our neighbors took out shortly after we moved in because they were having an issue with rats and were afraid they were harboring in the bushes. They were probably right. Since then, the slope has started to erode. I miss the privacy, and I found out that the original head and the slope is actually on our side of the property line. So I plan to plant a beautiful mixed hedge you introduced me to. Yeah. Could you please give me feedback on some of the plants I'm considering and suggest others that I missed which would be suitable? In general, we're moving towards lower water and native or naturalized plants. The main constraints are it would have to be either have a narrow upright growth habit or be able to be pruned to be only about 3 feet wide. Height 5 to 8 would be ideal. Bonus points for winter color when the roses aren't blooming, moderate, fast growth. And if I could reassure my neighbors that these plants aren't renowned for harboring or attracting rodents, that would be great.
Okay.
I just have to keep them limbed up to about 6 feet off the ground, right? Wait a minute. That's the rodent control.
Well, it could be part of it.
We're going to stop here and talk about this, and then we'll talk about the rest.
Yeah, but rodents like to go in a place where they have dense foliage and lots of cover, and they're undisturbed. And so just doing a more open planting will make a big difference, and limbing things up a little bit can make some difference. But the junipers and the very overgrown conifers like that are really inviting that kind of problem because of the habitat they provide. Wider spacing of your plants, thinning them out a little bit. The fact that you've now opened this up and driven away the ones that had lived in there before is probably a good starting point. I'm not going to promise that rodents won't take up residence in a plant, but they will not typically go in there and make a nest and build up the population if it's fairly open. They don't like to be exposed to the sky. They don't like to be out where they can be seen at night. We're usually talking about roof rats or tree rats here. So just keeping it more open is going to make a big difference. A solid wall of one shrub, even that doesn't automatically lead to rodent rat problems or squirrel problems. It's generally the density, the overgrowth, and the stuff piling up underneath them. When we're dealing with vertebrate pests, we take away food sources, nesting sites, habitat, and in your case, the food sources, well, unfortunately, fruit on a plant could be a food source, but that's not usually the biggest issue. Usually it's the habitat and the fact that you've created places that are undisturbed and that have been are undisturbed for months at a time. So if you keep it fairly open under the plant, that can make a big difference. I mean, that right there, you don't have to limb things up. If you do, let's say manzanita or something like that, you can let it grow naturally. Just don't plant them so close together. It's a solid overgrown mess of them. And that just is a wider spacing, a little bit of careful trimming to keep plants from just turning into this giant tangle. That's the best starting point for managing the rodent problem. I don't think your neighbor necessarily will believe me, but a plant that is kept more open is less likely to lead to habitat and nesting.
So I want to follow up on Don a little bit. If you were to look at your junipers or other of that ilk, and you were to look past the outside green layer, you'd find that it's a shell, and inside there are lots of little branches and things, but there's no growth. It's not full in there. It's got lots of places where you could build a nest and yet be hidden. Yeah. But if you were to look at your lilac bush or your manzanita or whatever, you would find that it isn't a hedge-like shell with stuff inside. It is branches, and you can see all the way into it and all the way through it. If you can see the central trunk, you're probably not going to have rats nesting there.
Nesting, correct. They might move through there, but they're not likely to settle in and be comfortable enough to have one of their 7 or 8 litters of babies this season. So
let's get back to the parts that she was looking at.
Yep.
And do you want me to read what she's considering or just want to tell
first,
her?
First issue, we have one free bubbler on the rose garden valve that we could hook up a drip line to and stake above the plants on the slope to water them regularly. At least will they establish? And she's using Netafim 24-inch spacing and so forth. The only issue I have here is that means that the plants you put in will need to be watered on the same timing and frequency, same duration and frequency as your roses. Roses like a lot of water. I mean, they love to be watered. They can tolerate drought, but they grow best and people are generally happiest if they give them like twice a week irrigation. If you go to low water plants during their first summer, that may be absolutely fine. Here's zone 19. I don't know what your soil is like, but very commonly, you would want to irrigate these new plants, yes, a couple times a week for the first several weeks, making sure you're getting the nursery soil properly hydrated. But then you'd need to back off of that. And many of the native plants like ceanothus and manzanitas will not be happy with twice a week watering. They certainly wouldn't be happy with it here in the valley once established. And once established is midsummer for us. So ultimately, I want you to be able to water these separately from your roses if you're going to go to California native plants or plants like that. So that's a consideration. You might need to run a separate valve or have a way to turn that part on and off. And there are devices you can find at your local drip irrigation supplier that allow you to do that. It's just a simple inline valve that allows you to simply turn off that part of the system intermittently. because by the middle to late part of the summer, you shouldn't be watering native plants that often, depending on your soil. So you might want to check locally as to whether they agree with my advice on this. But these are simple, like $3 devices that you just put in to the drip line and you just go out there and manually turn it off. You'll probably be able to get to that midsummer. I'm just concerned that as we get to the plants, you'll see they're mostly California natives. And most of those would not be on the same irrigation timing or frequency as rose bushes. So that's the first issue I have here. If you can resolve that, fine. And I don't think it's too difficult to resolve.
Okay, so let's talk about some actual plants. She has three Arctostaphylos, which are manzanitas, and she's talking about Rhamnus californica or Fragula california. That's the coffee berry or California buckthorn. Yep. And then Ceanothus, the snow flurry for the northern part of the row, which is in a light shade. So all of those seem like they're the plants for making the hedge. The tall plants. But what about the plants for holding down the soil? Wouldn't you want to have some ground cover kind of things?
The first thing she mentioned were three manzanitas. And the first one is one of the most famous manzanitas in California, which is the Howard McMinn manzanita. Now, that's a mounding shrub. It's not very big. Manzanitas of the Howard McMinn variety, for people in Davis who want to see some good examples, are out by the Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital. As you drive around on the west side, they were in full bloom a few weeks ago. And those are 5 or 6 feet tall after 40 years. Howard McMinn manzanita planted in most landscapes within 5 to 10 years gets about, in our area, gets about 3 feet tall, 4 to 5 feet across. Great slope cover, by the way. And the one thing I got to say about this one, it is the most widely adaptable manzanita. It's one of the most widely adaptable California native shrubs I have seen. I've seen Howard McMinn put into normal irrigated landscapes, which I would never recommend, but it has done fine. I've seen it put into low water landscapes in Davis area, down where Target is. It's in the shopping, in the parking lot landscaping out there, doing just great. So it's a great choice and might be good for you on the slope part because it will spread out somewhat. You may be in a zone where the ground cover forms of manzanita do better. We have almost zero success with them here in the Sacramento Valley. Emerald carpet and the other ground hugging versions of Arctostaphylos, Uva ursi, they just die out here in the valley because we get too hot and the soils are too dense and they hold too much nutrient and hold too much water. And I have just seen spectacular failures here in our area with the ground cover forms of manzanita. But I am told that in Southern California and coastal zones, they're actually quite successful if you water them correctly. Emerald carpet has become widely adopted by landscape architects for use in commercial plantings. And in many places in California, it does very well. Those of you listening here in the Sacramento Valley, I have never seen it do well. So if you're listening here, don't think about this one. But zone 19 down there, you probably will do well with that. Experiment with some of the ground cover forms of manzanita on that slope. There's other ground covers we could talk about. Ribes viburnifolium is another good example of something that spreads out and tends to root as it goes. So it would help to hold the slope as well. These are more for the slope part because they don't get tall enough to give the privacy. There are manzanitas that do get big, as you know. And one of the most adaptable of that group, I keep saying that because a lot of manzanitas just don't work in a lot of normal irrigated landscapes. A lot of them are very susceptible to crown and root rot, Phytophthora. But there is a handful of cultivars that have been introduced over the years that just seem widely adaptable. Lewis Edmonds is an upright growing manzanita that I have seen succeed in the Davis area. It becomes like a large shrub or small tree. It's beautiful. It's got the winter bloom. That's one of the nice things about manzanitas is that wintertime flowering. There's little berries that you and I don't really notice as much, but the songbirds apparently love them. And it has that same beautiful mahogany trunk that's so spectacular that people are really, one of the main features of manzanita is the beauty of the bark. So it's more of a tree-like one. Lewis Edmonds. And there's a couple others that you might find at your local garden center that are more upright. Howard McMinn won't do what you're after in terms of size and privacy, but it'll be great on the slope part, as might be some of the ground cover forms. Ceanothus. Well, there's a group of plants that dies rapidly here in the valley. I've gotten to the point where I don't even want to sell them, but there are many places in California where they do very well, like places where they're actually native. They're not native in Yolo County or Solano County. They're not native to our area. So they're so popular because of the bloom and the fragrance and all that kind of thing. But in general, ceanothus struggle in dense soils and areas like the valley. However, Southern California, coastal zones, everywhere where you've got slight slope, they can do quite well. Yankee Point is a ceanothus, much like Howard McMinn Manzanita. Yankee Point ceanothus seems to grow anywhere, seems to be quite resistant to crown rot, as far as we can tell. Almost anywhere you're listening in California, it's likely to do well for you. You mentioned snow flurry, which I have seen do well. So that's another possibility. I just want people to understand with ceanothus, you see the comment in the garden book and other places, they're quote short-lived, end quote. No, they're very vulnerable to Phytophthora crown and root rot. And so anywhere they get irrigated, where it gets hot in the summer, you get 90 degrees plus, and you're having to irrigate them in the summer, they're going to be very vulnerable to this crown and root rot. And they're very rarely a long-lived plant here in the valley, because we get late rain, April or May, that unfortunately can lead to crown or root rot. You're not controlling that. But in Southern California and in the coastal zones, you can try different types. And the snow flurry is one that seems to be pretty well adapted as well. Joyce Coulter, Concha, a couple of others. You got room for Ray Hartman. Cool. It's a 15 to 20 foot plant, so be aware of that when you plant that. But anytime you plant ceanothus, interplant it with something that you know isn't going to be vulnerable to crown and root rot. So here I always say, plant a toyon with your ceanothus 6 or 7 feet away. Just about the time the ceanothus dies because of the crown rot, after 3 to 5 years, the toyon will be 8 or 10 feet tall and will be giving you the privacy you're after. So toyon is certainly a possibility to add to this collection of privacy plants.
So I noticed in here she said that the lawn at the top of the slope is being watered by her neighbor. So is
Yeah.
it definitely going to get lawn watering onto some of these plants, even though they're on a slope and it'll run off pretty quick? I'm wondering if, since it's a rose garden down below, what about putting a giant rose like iceberg as part of the privacy hedge?
Well, I would personally probably add some informal roses, because I really like the ones that don't have to be pruned and that give lots of color all on their own. Iceberg is an extremely adaptable rose. It's sold as a Floribunda, but it's really a lot bigger than most Floribunda roses. There's a whole lot of other roses you could look into. Now, they're not low water in general. Roses are, they bloom best if you give them plenty of water. But to transition into this planting, Lois's suggestion is really good. Maybe look into some of the roses that are more informal. They sell them as landscape or shrub roses. Look at some of the China roses, like Old Blush. There's varieties out there. You'll have to look around for them. I'd be more than happy to talk about the informal low-care shrub roses that I have, that I've done extremely well for me, that you could just plant uphill from your existing roses, and then transition from those into the native or the more drought-tolerant plants that might get even less irrigation over time. That would be a good way to make this look like you don't just have like a rose garden here and a landscape there. One of the problems I have with the way roses have been used in landscapes historically everywhere, but especially in California, is this grid pattern planting of roses in their own little silo. Roses should be part of your landscape. I like your rose garden. It looks really nice, but there's big open areas in between the plants. The fact that you have them open like that is great. It reduces disease problems, but it tends to look a little bare between them, especially in the winter when you have to prune them back. So don't hesitate to plant some things in between them. Don't hesitate to plant some less formal roses outside of the existing grid of roses, and then sort of have that grade into a lower water, more informal landscape. Incorporate them into the planting that you're doing here. And a really simple way to do that would be to just pick two or three larger roses that you're not going to prune. You're going to let them grow more naturally and have them be the backdrop to what you're doing here. I'll give you an example from my own yard right now, too. Puerto Rico is called a found rose. I bought it from Antique Rose Emporium down in Texas 5 years ago. I've left it completely unpruned. My plant is now 8 feet tall, at least 12 feet across, and has 500 to 600 flowers on it right now, bright white flowers, absolutely carefree. I haven't pruned it in all these years that I've had it. And it's this great big background plant of just bright white blooms. Puerto Rico, found rose is a term we use for old roses that were found in cemeteries and cottages and who knows where. They didn't know the name of it, so they just put a name on it until they can properly identify it, and they sell them to us as clearly successful roses with low input that have been just growing in Lubbock, Texas, or down in Louisiana, or someplace that somebody found it and thought, this is worth reintroducing. So that's one you can find. Another one that I have, and we have a couple of them around Davis that people ask me about every so often, Old Blush. Old Blush is a China rose from the 1700s. It's when it was first brought into the United States, been grown in China for centuries. It bloomed right through the winter for me, as these often do. They will definitely do it in Southern California. Old Blush is a pink flowered rose, a big sprawling shrub about 6 to 8 feet across. You don't have to prune them at all. And in most parts of California, at least lowland California, they'll bloom all around the calendar, all the way through the winter, all year round. So look for a couple of those and see if those interest you. And that would be a way to make your rose garden incorporate into your new privacy planting. Also be aware, if your neighbors are watering their lawn, that is affecting plants downslope. So you might be able to back off of the irrigation of your low water plants pretty quickly. You'll just be using that drip system we've talked about that's attached to the rose garden to water them until establishment. Poke around with a trowel, see if you're getting moisture from above because of the lawn watering. And it's a good possibility that you will not have to irrigate low water plants on that slope in the future. You'll just have to get them to that established point where you can count on the neighbors watering to give them what they need. And be aware that since you don't control that watering, apparently, it might be too much for some of the native plants we're talking about. You'll be experimenting a little bit. You'll find that some things take it, some things don't. You might have to change your, you know, make some changes midstream. A couple of years down the road, if the ceanothus haven't worked, put in an arbutus instead and see how that works for you. Let's go on through a couple more of the plants that she was asking about.
I think we did them all. Arctosophilus, Rhamnus.
Oh, Rhamnus. Okay. Yeah, Rhamnus, my experience with coffee berry is it's slow to get going. It's more vulnerable to root and crown rot than, say, Toyon, which gives a very similar look. But one advantage of the Rhamnus californica, yes, now it's called Frangilla californica, California buckthorn or coffee berry, there's a couple of dwarf varieties that have come on the market that are really useful, 4 to 6 foot varieties, whereas the regular form is a 10 to 12 foot plant comparable to Toyon. So if you don't really think you have room for the great big one, look for a couple of the dwarf types.
Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about the garden. This we're finished with the questions. We're done with that. I'm looking at your picture. It's a beautiful rose garden, yeah. And she put chips everywhere. It's great. Yep. She's done the chip drop thing. Yep. I'm wondering if you like to have people come and enjoy your roses. What do you think about making some little paths, either with chips or maybe with stepping stones or whatever, and then planting every place else with a ground cover? And I'm thinking something, like a campanula. They have a white form of campanula. That would be very pretty. She likes sunset colors. She doesn't like blues and purples, but mm-hmm. There's white forms of most of the things that Don talks about when he talks about covering.
The chip drop is great. You've got wood chips everywhere, and that's fantastic for the soil. And they're a little chunky to walk on. So what I would probably have done as the last step, and you can still do, is go get a very fine pathway bark, just buy a couple bags of it, and make a path through there. Make a meandering path through the rose garden where you walk to cut the flowers, where you go in. And these kinds of things are very inviting. So you have to consider whether you actually want to invite people into your rose garden or not. So that's one thing to think about. But a pathway bark or micro bark, a path through there, and here and there on the edges of the actual path that you've now created, I would probably have little tufts of fescue, for example. It's a grass that grows well. I would put in some Delasperma ice plant ground cover because it's blooming so spectacularly right now. There would be some sedum or some of the related succulents like that that go nicely along paths like this. I've seen people really effectively use hen and chicks. So we're talking about some succulents here, which are very low water and would help to kind of harmonize it all with the other plants you're talking about. There are things that are purple that I would mention, Nepeta, but you don't like purple, so let's not talk about those. And there are dianthus, which are pink, and those work well. There's ground cover forms of dianthus, which have fragrant flowers. One of my employees planted chamomile in his garden bed, and I can assure you that if you ask him about chamomile, he'll roll his eyes and say, oh, it reseeds like crazy, but that's okay. In a place like this, having things reseeding like crazy wouldn't be such a big problem. In fact, having some annual flowers like that around would be a nice, nice bonus. So I would think about some plants to fill the areas in between the roses and some sort of an interesting meandering path so that you could kind of link this all together. Pulling together disparate parts of a landscape is one of the big challenges that landscape designers have, where you've got someone who wants a vegetable garden and a rose garden, and these will be the native plants. And good designers can integrate them. They can actually make it so you're walking from one, let's say, higher usage area, like the vegetable garden, to a more meandering area, like the rose garden, having a backdrop of the native plants and shrubs that give seasonal change that you just walk by occasionally. And that's a really effective thing to do. And a path can do that. But also choosing plants that can grade. So I talked about some roses that could be a backdrop to the existing roses that could then grade into the lower water plants uphill. And a simple path through there with some plants along it can be very, very inviting. And again, we're going to say this again, don't forget flower bulbs, because they'll fit very nicely in this kind of thing. One of the most effective things in my rose garden is a planting of February gold daffodils that I did 35 years ago. I just planted a couple dozen, actually less than that. I think I planted 12 bulbs total along a path. Now, once you got all the roses cut back, and in the old days, it would look pretty bleak out there. And then all of a sudden, it's February gold variety. And this one actually blooms here at the end of January, the first week of February. Pop, there it is, giving you some bloom in an otherwise rather austere landscape. So that's one of the big advantages of some of these winter bulbs and some of the winter blooming perennials like hellebores and cyclamen and things like that. Keep them in mind. Once you've got your backbone plants of these woody things and you've got this charming little path that we've all created together now and the little perennials and the grasses, look for places where you like spots of yellow and red and pink to be blooming at different seasons and use some flower bulbs for that purpose.
So we've gotten really far off of the question, and that's fine, because I love looking at pictures like this and looking at things. And if it were my yard, if I were in this situation, you know what I'd do is I'd have a fence built, a nice, you know, rustic looking fence along wherever the property line is. And then I'd plant, well, Lady Banks roses. It's a rose.
It's too big.
But it would cover that fence. And
way too big for this.
In the spring when it bloomed. And when it doesn't bloom, it's gorgeous anyway. It's nice and green, but it wouldn't get rats. And it would be great.
It would not be my choice because it's a 60-foot plant. So I would think of roses for this, and there's lots of choices, but that one would turn into a fair bit of pruning. Now, they don't actually, the one thing I like about this, they don't actually need a fence, because they don't really have, you know, a situation here where you've got neighbors out using their yard. An informal planting, and I'm looking at this picture. If you folks send us pictures like this, this is great, because I could see 8 to 10 plants artfully chosen, not in a straight line, put them in groups of two of this and then one offset of that and one of this and two offset of that, different heights and textures, deciduous flowering shrubs like flowering quince mixed with some of the things we've talked about, some of the native ribes if you're down at a shadier end. I mean, if you're focusing on natives, but there's lots of non-native Mediterranean plants, Australian plants that would fit. Go look at Corea pulchella, the Australian fuchsia, which is a ground covering shrub that blooms mid-winter. Look at some of the grevilleas, which attract hummingbirds like crazy. Some of them get quite big. And if you want to make a real barrier plant, some of them are rather prickly. So I have, as an example, a hedge of grevillea pink pearl. Each plant is now about 8 by 8. So you'd only have room for one, but it never stops blooming. It's in spectacular bloom right now, but it's also in bloom midwinter and late summer, and hummingbirds absolutely love it. I wouldn't put a whole hedge of those in unless you don't like your neighbor, because it's a very prickly plant, but it is a great plant when you can give it enough room to develop and bloom all the time and draw these hummingbirds. So a combination of California natives with Southwestern natives, like some of the salvias, Australian natives, like the grevilleas and Koreas, you can use that mix of things that are so well adapted to California's Mediterranean rainfall climate that you can get bloom year round, draw beneficials, draw hummingbirds, draw butterflies just by having so much bloom out there. And all the things we're talking about would be very low water plants. So consider some of the natives, consider things from other parts of the world that are compatible on the irrigation as well. The main mistake I see in these situations is planting too many things too close together, or planting things that are too big, like a Lady Banks rose. So putting things 6 to 10 feet apart, if they're bigger shrubs, lower perennials around them if you just want to fill space, giving something like a big rose enough room to develop to its full potential so you don't feel like you have to prune it. And you can just get this lovely informal hedge, border, whatever you want to call it, that'll provide, you know, wildlife, but not the wrong kind of wildlife. We all like hummingbirds, none of us like rats. So we want to draw the right kind of wildlife without encouraging the disagreeable ones.
As usual, Don sends over a list of some of the questions he got in this week, and frequently they're timely, and sometimes they're just strange. So it's a mixed bag, but today we have strange questions.
Yes.
Why is it so hard to find wisteria plants to plant?
Wisteria, which is an amazing vine, super fragrant, wonderful, vigorous vine. Lois and I both have had experiences with wisteria overtaking parts of our properties. To get a wisteria that I can promise you will bloom anytime soon, it needs to be grafted. You grow wisteria from seed very easily. It's quite easy from seed, especially Chinese wisteria, Wisteria sinensis, the short cluster type. It takes 7 to 10 years for a seed-grown wisteria to bloom. Like many woody vines, it has to go through an actual hormonal phase change of maturation where it then finally starts blooming. So it grows vigorously. You'll have the vine you're after, and you'll wait and wait and wait till it finally bloom. No, there's no fertilizer, no nothing. If you bought a good if you bought a wisteria and it was low price or was in a one-gallon container, you don't see a graft union down there, congratulations, you have a seedling. You'll have to wait 7 to 10 years for it to bloom. Grafting wisterias is complicated. Growing vines is a big hassle for wholesale growers, I can tell you. Keeping them in an orderly manner in their wholesale yards is challenging. And there's a pretty high failure rate from graft. So it has to be something they know there's going to be a big market for. There was one big grower of wisteria vines that pretty much supplied the whole industry until 2017 when they closed. And no one else has picked up that particular part of the market because it is a challenge. There's a lot that goes into that. So availability of wisteria has been very, very poor since they retired, closed up, went out of business. That's a big part of the problem right there. If you are looking in a garden center, particularly one of the hardware chains, look closely. If the price is good, it may be too good to be true. You want to look closely and make sure there's a graft union down there and you're not buying something that's going to take forever to bloom. But that's the main reason. The other is demand for an extremely vigorous vine that's woody can swallow up a house is not as high as you might think. So we used to sell a lot of them, and I'd get people buying them, and they'd be saying, no, I want to put this on my little fence near my, oh, no, not a little fence. No, this is a plant that needs a substantial structure.
This plant can grow to the top of your redwood tree.
Yes.
No problem.
Yes. We had it grow to the top of a 35-foot clump of bamboo on our property, which was quite spectacular when it came into bloom because we hadn't known it had snuck into the bamboo. So this is a giant Bambusa vulgaris on my farm, 35 feet tall. I know because I measured one of the culms when we cut it down. And it had been sitting in a pot behind the clump of bamboo. It was getting watered automatically and it rooted into the ground. We didn't notice this. And one day, about 3 years after it rooted into the ground, I walk out there and my bamboo is in massive purple flower, which doesn't do that kind of bloom. Yes, the wisteria had completely engulfed the bamboo. So it's a very vigorous vine and ultimately makes a trunk as big as a tree. So you don't just put this casually on a house. You don't just casually put it on a fence or something like that. As Lois can attest, it can climb up a nearby plant and swallow it up. And then you have a pretty big job on your hands. So you need a structure. You need an arbor that's constructed well and that you can, this is important, that you can get up into to prune. So an arbor with a fairly open structure is really your best way to do wisteria. Not a tight one where you can't get up there. It's just going to pile up on top. Now you need to be able to get up there and prune it away, thin it out every now and then so you don't get a fire hazard and rodent habitat. So the demand for this vine is not what most people think it is, but the main reason is that it's a complicated thing to produce one that's going to bloom quickly, and there just aren't that many growers doing that.
The nice thing about removing wisteria is that it has a tree trunk size support system.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you cut that thing down and you take out a couple of feet, nothing's going to grow above it.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's not like one of these little vines that sends tendrils up every 5 feet. No, this is all coming from that one wisteria that somebody planted 50 years ago.
Yeah, and it grows a lot like a grape. You want to have a structure that can support it that you can basically prune it back to every now and then. So plan ahead when you put them in for how you're going to maintain them. I guess that's true for any vine. As I've said many times, my very worst landscape mistakes have almost all been vines and certain roses. It's because I didn't plan for how vigorous they were going to be. And that's really important. I see someone buying a white potato vine or the pink jasmine, and I think, I've spent a lot of time pulling this plant out of where it ran to. So put it where you can manage the size and the spread easily. I was just in a yard where Algerian ivy is now in 4 yards. It came from one and it's gone into 4 yards, and they're all gonna have to work together to get rid of it. And I can tell you from experience, Algerian ivy is a very hard one to get rid of. So let's not make problems for each other by planting woody vines where there's not easy access to them. There was another question that was right on that same document.
Yeah, the next question on his list is someone came in saying, I'm looking for a native vine.
Yeah.
Okay, I
Well,
think you need more information, Don.
yeah, it depends on where you're listening. Here in California, we have an incredible resource for native plants, calscape.org. It's a project of the California Native Plant Society, and it's an interactive database where you can go in, put in your zip code, put in the category of plant you're after, and up will come the things that are actually native in your area. And when you do that with vines for 95616, you get three choices. I was surprised that one vine wasn't on there. We'll come back to that. The three choices are Dutchman's pipe, the Aristolochia californica, which is a very important food source for the pipe vine swallowtail. Pardon my opinion here, but I think it's a fairly scruffy looking vine. It does not exactly sell itself in terms of its appearance. The flower is interesting. It looks like a Dutchman's pipe. Has a slight fetid odor. Other members of the genus have a very much a dead animal smell to them. Let's just say it's not a pleasant odor, but it's not too bad on the native one. But that's one. Second was a clematis species that is native here, more or less. I think if it's more native, slightly upslope as you get towards Lake Berryessa. Again, it's pretty interesting. I like it, but it's not a showy clematis like you're thinking of. It's not the great big flowered one. So that's the other option. And the third one, which kind of surprised me, was the close relative of the field bindweed that's actually native. So there's a morning glory bindweed, Calystegia, formerly convolvulus, that is native here. And then there's the one that's not native here. And the only way I can tell them apart is the not native one has white flowers and the native one has light pink flowers, but there's pink variants of the not native one too. Also, the native one is less vigorous. However, I don't think most people are going to want to plant a cousin of field bindweed as an ornamental in their yard. And those are the only three species of native vines that are listed for 95616. I was surprised Vitis californica didn't pop up because it should be. I mean, it's a
What
riparian
is that?
California grape.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly native up in in the Coast Range, and it's certainly native along the Sacramento and American rivers. It's a beautiful vine. So of the native vines, I would probably go towards that one, bearing in mind that it does produce fruit, and the fruit is seedy, although very tasty, but somewhat tart and a little astringent. And it's a very vigorous plant, has beautiful fall color. And you're looking like a grapevine, a 30-foot vine easily. But that of the ones that are actually native here, as I say, I don't know why that one didn't show up on the list, but it should. That would be my first choice. My second choice would be if you can broaden your category to include things that are kind of native. The hybrid Rogers Red Grape is an amazing landscape plant. It's a cross, we know by gene sequencing, between Vitis californica and a champagne grape. It occurred naturally, spontaneously in Sonoma County. Roger Raish, well-known horticulturist in the Sonoma County area, was rounding a corner in wine country in the fall and saw this blazing red fall color on a plant growing by the side of the road. And he got out and he took cuttings of it and he propagated it. And Rogers Red Vitis californica crossed with a champagne grape is an extremely ornamental grape with spectacular fall color. It's worth growing for the fall color. It does set fruit. I have one. It sets very large amounts of fruit. They have seeds, so that's not all that desirable, but they're very flavorful. So you could make juice out of them. You could even make wine out of them if you were so inclined. But I was waiting for mine to produce fruit to see what the quality is. Yes, you could use it. You could use it for grape juice. Just be aware that it does produce a lot of fruit. So of the native vines that's sort of native, that would be my first choice. Second would be Vitis californica. Aristolochia, the Dutchman's pipe, is fun because you get the butterflies, but it's not really a vine in the ornamental sense. And the other two I would probably skip. But those are your choices for native vines. More to the point, wherever you're listening in California, calscape.org, type in your address or your zip code or something, and you can find shrubs, vines, whatever category you're looking at for your area. And it can be very, very informative. I do this all the time when people ask about what are some native trees for our area. Regrettably, we don't have very many because of where we are, but this is a good way to show you what the options are within our native species. calscape.org.
And the next question is, now, first I should say EB Stone is a brand. It's made by a particular company, and we refer to it a lot because that's what Don sells a lot of. So here's the question. Is EB Stone the only soil you sell? My friend who's been gardening for like 40 years told me to my blank brand. I need some potting soil and some planting mix. Not the same thing, two different things.
They're not the same thing at all. Planting mix is a meaningless term. I really wish our industry wouldn't do this to people, because planting mix, at least in theory, is a soil amendment. And there's another bit of jargon. It's something you turn into the soil when you're planting into it, into a garden. But that's what a planting mix is, a potting soil.
I assumed a planting mix is what you put in a pot for a houseplant.
Exactly not. Exactly not. And that's the problem. No, it is not at all. And that's the problem. If you buy something called planting mix and plant in it in a container, it's not going to do well. You've basically just planted in compost or something like compost. And so planting mix is a meaningless term. And it frustrates me. It is essentially a soil amendment, which means probably some reasonably composted shavings or byproducts of some industry that produces a lot of this stuff. Mushroom compost is used as a planting mix in coastal areas. Down in the southeastern United States, they use ground pine bark. Up in Canada, they use peat moss. Those are all being used as planting mix. You're putting them on the soil, turning them into the where the plant is going, and planting into this mix of native soil and compost or whatever. That's what planting mix is.
So if planting mix isn't for planting houseplants,
right,
what is for planting houseplants? What's the I know that's a junk term, but what term should I look for
potting
if I
soil.
Want to plant house?
Potting soil. Yes, that's what you should look for. Again, there's no standardization, okay, but generally speaking, all the companies, including EB Stone, who we work with, Happy Frog, Fox Farm, Scott's Miracle-Gro, all of them, generally refer to something where you're planting in containers as potting soil. Planting mix is just something to put on the ground. Now, we will tell you, as you're buying a tree or a shrub from us, don't use planting mix. And that advice is so well substantiated by decades now of horticultural research that it's frustrating that we still have to say this. But people go out and they want to buy a tree and they're ready to buy a bag of planting mix. Well, there's a lot of nurseries that'll say, yes, buy that bag of planting mix. It's a natural tie-in sale. First nursery I worked at, we were supposed to ask every customer who was buying plants, did you need some planting mix to go with that, ma'am? And they would go, oh, I don't know, do I? And you'd take them over and you'd show them, here's the one for azaleas, here's the one for citrus, and so forth. We know that woody plants, shrubs and trees in particular, if you put them in a soil that's been amended with stuff, we'll anthropomorphize here. The roots get lazy. They stay in the amended soil and they take a longer time to penetrate out into the native soil. So the tree will not be anchored as well. It'll be more challenging to keep it watered. It just doesn't do as well. It appears to do as well. The early studies on this found that because you would see more vigorous growth when you use planting mix, that would prompt people to buy it and use it in the future. Well, the thing that was causing them to grow was the nitrogen part. Almost every planting mix had some kind of fertilizer in it. When they took that out, it did not improve the results. And when they dug the trees up later, these are the important studies, dig the trees up several years later, the roots of those planted into native soil had expanded out properly, were anchoring the tree well. Those planted into amended soil were not doing so. They did not develop as well. So it actually wasn't just, it was the classic question we ask when a product or a practice is being recommended, is it necessary? Is it harmful? We used to think, okay, well, it's not necessary, but it's not harmful. Then they did the studies which show it's actually harmful for woody plants, shrubs, and trees in general. If you're planting a flower border, if you're planting vegetables, it's absolutely fine to amend the soil for those things, but be aware those plants may spend the whole season in that enriched amended soil. If you pull up a petunia that you've put into a bed where you've dug in a bunch of stuff, you pull it out at the end of the season, you'll probably find its roots are almost entirely in the amended soil portion, not down further, not further out. So it's okay to do that as long as you're giving them the water that they need and people get perfectly good results. We're not worried about the anchorage of the root system of a petunia, but it's not particularly any benefit. So when you're buying these products, what we really suggest now is plant the plant in your native soil. Take that bag you bought and mulch all around the plant with it. Compost is fine for that. Planting mix, whatever they're calling it, is fine for that. And if you happen to have potting soil, I suppose that's fine for that as well. That has a bunch of functions. It shades the soil, helps to shade the roots a bit. It retains moisture, retains nutrients, and it also generally provides some nutrients. And then it slowly works its way into your soil at the rate that's appropriate to your soil, microorganisms, your temperature, your moisture status. So when you put it on the surface, it's all good. When you mix it in, it actually can be detrimental. Avoid planting mixes in general. Potting soils are what you're after when you're growing something in a container, and that includes a tub, a raised planter bed in many cases, a livestock trough. You're going to want a potting soil for that. As we've said many times, quality of potting soils varies quite a bit. Check the label as to whether it has nutrients added. If not, you'll probably need to supplement that. But potting soil is what you need when you're growing in a container or something like a container, like a raised bed in many cases. Just look on the label and see what's in it. That's really the first thing. I really recommend people start reading product labels, but be aware that planting mix in particular doesn't mean what you think it does. I mean, Lois's reaction was the same thing we get all the time. I'm transplanting my houseplant. I need some planting mix. Ooh, actually what you need is potting soil.
Okay, here's the last question on this little list. Someone was in there. They were looking at something. They were reading a label and said, this label says, quote, border perennial, unquote. Yeah. So I can't keep it in a pot?
Our nursery industry uses a lot of jargon.
Yeah.
I have come to realize that it's those of us who read, you know, like books by English gardeners that use terms like border. Do you have a border, Lois? A flower border? A perennial border?
I don't know what you're talking about, Don. We have a sidewalk.
Right. We have a garden. Well, a border refers typically to the kind of landscape that Gertrude Jekyll, famous landscape designer at the turn of the 20th or beginning of the 20th century, was doing, where you have a deep bed that's comprised of a mix of flowering perennials and maybe some low shrubs. Classic kind of late 19th century, early 20th century garden bed. Not formal, but artfully contrived, artfully arranged so that the plants look natural. And you're putting in things like daylilies, agapanthus, herbaceous perennials like penstemons, some of the salvias. Those types of things are what we would use in a border here. They're fine in pots. They're just basically saying this is a good thing to put out with your other flowers, I guess is the best way to read that. Border is just a collection of flowering plants grouped together for that purpose. Yes, of course, they can go in a container. The question is, how big does the plant get and how big does the root system get? And I will say this now so that you all who are making planting decisions will not make a mistake. The bigger, the better for your container.
And it says it's a perennial. So that means that it's going to keep growing its roots more and more and more.
Yeah.
And it really would like to get down to the earth and in and out and all over the place.
And
so if you're putting it in a pot, maybe think about annuals, because they go away and you put a new one in and it regrows a little root system, and it's not huge.
People are often surprised how big plant roots will get if they can. I mean, we've mentioned tomato roots can go 4 feet deep, so can watermelon roots. Many perennials have roots that would go 2 to 3 feet deep, 2 to 3 feet out or more if they can. Some of them are rather big, fleshy roots, like sort of the classic California plant, agapanthus, the lily of the Nile. Sure, you can do it in a container, but it'll be root bound by the second summer and you'll be having to water it constantly. Daylilies have surprisingly big root systems. So the biggest issue with containers here in the valley, this comes up with tomatoes, but it also comes up with flowering perennials and things like that. Once a plant is root bound, as any nursery owner and or employee can tell you, it needs water every day. It may, if it's in a really small pot, need water twice a day. And so here in our hot, dry interior climate, that just becomes your limiting factor. How are you going to keep everything watered? By hand? Okay, well, that's what we do. That's job number one at any garden center, is watering the plants almost every day. If you're a human that has an actual life, you want to go away for a weekend, or you just do things and you forget, you know, that you're not out there every day looking at your garden as more avid gardeners are, I do suggest that you get some kind of a system so that it's just getting watered at least automatically somehow. But the bigger the container, the easier it'll be. I've gotten to the point where I would say the smallest container I'm going to use for anything is a 15-gallon nursery pot, which holds 1.5 cubic feet of soil. That's what I use for flowers, for, you know, that I'm testing, for peppers that I want to try out, and so forth. That's the absolute minimum size I would use for a tomato plant. Even better is something the size of a half barrel, which holds a little more than 3 cubic feet of soil. So you can go 2, 3, 4 days between watering plants that are in barrels. And even better, in my opinion, is this trend towards these livestock troughs, because they'll hold 5 to 10 cubic feet of soil. So your life is a lot easier. So even though they're not connected to the soil below, at least you have a large soil volume. It's not as difficult to keep them watered. That's really the challenge here. Now, my mom, coastal San Diego, after dad died, I was down there helping her out with stuff. She had 82 container plants around the patio that she hand watered. Right. Wow. And she did that, you know, well into old age. Well, first of all, coastal San Diego, she could get by with once a week on container plants. Also, she was heavily focused on succulents, which is a good category if you happen to be wanting to get into plants without a lot of watering. But it was that climate was milder, and so it was possible. We talked earlier in the show about fuchsias. Daily watering for sure here in the summer, and you're going to forget one day and the whole plant is going to wither and die. So the bigger the container, the better. I think really that's the key takeaway from all of this.
Did you say fuchsias have to be watered every day?
In a hanging basket, absolutely.
Oh, well, yeah. Hanging baskets don't make it in Davis.
In general,
sorry.
No, that's correct. In general, they don't. And I've had people walk into my nursery like they just moved here from the Midwest or someplace where it actually rains in the summer. Where are all your hanging petunias? And I say, well, you have to water them twice a day. Okay. And they're going to get budworm. Is it really worth that to you? So honestly, the only hanging baskets I recommend here are ivy geraniums, the new ivy geranium hybrids, or succulents. Those are going to be successful for you.
Well, we end our shows with a garden quote usually. And I had to go out and look for some more because we've used up all the ones that I started this off with. If you have a favorite garden quote or a, you know, two-line poem or something like that, feel free to send it in. And where do they send things, John?
Well, davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
And that's the same place that you'd send pictures you want to brag about or questions you want to ask. So here is our garden quote for today. The garden year has no beginning and no end.
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California. Mayday, Mayday. May 1st is the annual Big Day of Giving, a 24-hour event connecting local folks like you with local nonprofits like Catered. So please help us continue to do our work in the community. Donate during the Big Day of Giving, which some folks call Big Dog, by visiting davismedia.org/bigdog before midnight. Thank you very much. Mayday, Mayday, Mayday.